back of Fox News, and now they've become the most pro-Trump station you can find anywhere on the cable dial.
Finally, we have just 30 seconds, but you went to college with Sean Spicer, Jack.
I did go to college with Sean Spicer. I went to Connecticut College, a very PC liberal arts school. He was one of about 10 openly Republican kids on campus, very loud about it. His nickname in college was Sean Sphincter, so it gives you an idea of his popularity. But it was surprising to see where he's wound up, but I certainly recognize the guy that I went to college with.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Joshua Green, senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek. His new book, Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. That does it for today's show. If you want to read transcripts, video, or audio podcast, you can go to democracynow.org. You can also sign up for our daily news headlines there. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gadasdiner, Sam Malkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Trina Ndura, Andre Lewis, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Paul Huckabee, our engineers. Special thanks to Nicole Salazar. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Playing Monopoly with God and Other True Stories on August 4th, 7 p.m. at the Old Church in Portland. Playing Monopoly with God and Other True Stories will be performed by Melissa Bangs, who studied with the Upright Citizens Brigade. This is her one-woman comedy show about postpartum psychosis and healing through shared moments, laughter, and tears. Again, that's Playing Monopoly with God and Other True Stories on August 4th, 7 p.m. at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
This is KBOO Portland.
To be or not to be, to be or not to be.
Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows and reaper drones of those who make outrageous fortunes from the suicide bomb of fossil fuel. Sacrifice zone for the 1% in their green zones.
To be or not to be, to be or not to be. To be or not to be,
to be engaged in this existential struggle.
To be or not to be,
between life on earth and an economic model, or to take arms against a rising sea of troubles, and by opposing them from the ground up.
By the axis of descent, on behalf of the 99%.
We'll take our power from the wind and sun,
and leave the oil in the ground.
Demand clean air and fresh clean water,
and leave the oil in the ground.
And we'll be singing, die, 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 die. Die capitalism must die. Die, die, barricades.
Hold on the barricades.
The empire of fossil fuel has added far too good
for far too long.
But all things must pass, all things decay.
Starting today.
The lack of separation between state and corporation.
Good morning. Welcome to Wednesday Talk Radio once again. I'm your host, Paul Roland, and we have a couple guests this morning, Barbara Ford and Maya Jared, and I'll be introducing them after I read this introduction. So on last week's show with Robert Hunsaker, talking about the Michael Wallace Wells article, The Uninhabitable Earth, we intended to talk a little more about this difficult subject of how best to talk about the worst case scenarios of climate disruption. We mostly just talked about those very worst case scenarios themselves. Was it an effective conversation? Was it empowering or disempowering? These are very difficult and bewildering times, and obviously not just because of the climate emergency. In this program, with guests Barbara Ford and Maya Jared, we'll talk more about how we cope personally with being overwhelmed by it all and find strength in ourselves and with others to persevere and hopefully be more effective, whatever that might mean. Barbara is a climate activist with 350PDX and coordinates the 350PDX Climate Odyssey program, which aims to support activists through community building, resilience practices, arts, and anti-oppression training. And I know she also conducts workshops on these issues around town and elsewhere. Maya is a community organizer and volunteer coordinator for 350PDX, a local chapter of the international organization 350.org. And she brings a young person's perspective to the future we're talking about. At the same time, in the light of the Wallace Wells article and others like it, it is important to me to be as cognizant as we are able regarding the real-time developing dynamics of climate change. In light of the reality, to the extent we are able to understand it, what actually has a chance of changing that dynamic, if anything, of bringing some stability back into the global climate system? Our various proposed plans, solutions, policies, technologies, even assuming they can be implemented, which is a big question mark, actually capable of having a sufficient influence to make the necessary difference, which brings us back around to how to talk about worst-case scenarios, beginning with how we talk to ourselves and those around us. It's probably not helpful to avoid the subject, as these are very real possibilities, but it can also be paralyzing because of the immensity of the problem. Climate change, as well as everything that has created and propels it forward. So let's talk about it. So, reactions, Barbara?
This is a land that I've been inhabiting for quite a while now. The details of the news are somewhat new from what I've heard before, but the reality of the possible future has been with me for a while, and my sort of what's driven my particular work with people around, you know, who will we be no matter what, so I sort of watched this online kind of flurry of responses to the article, and I think everybody holds a little piece of the truth about how it's going to affect the movement and that kind of thing. But for me personally, I think that people are, whether they know it or not, are longing for a piece of truth, that at least some people are. And so those people deserve to have an affirmation of what many of us just know in our bodies, because we are actually not separate from the world, the planet, the Earth, that there's something to say about truth telling that, even though it's very, very hard truth, is relieving to people because it's no longer underground. It's no longer feeling like a big lie. And I say that at the same time as I say that from my work and my studies that we actually don't know exactly what's going to go down. We can have, there's lots of estimates and there's lots of ideas. So there's a little piece of humility that I hold around letting myself not know exactly. I'm not counting on it, but that there's a piece that I'm holding of that also.
Maya?
Good morning. The gravity of the horrible situations listed in this new news article that came out, the uninhabitable Earth, this is exactly the type of scenario I've been living with and why I've been delaying decisions about, well, which grad school program would I go into or what career path do I want to look at? Because I've been grappling with how do I deal with the fact that I might die because of a disease that's been unearthed from the Arctic permafrost that's been dormant for thousands of years, or I might die because all of our staple food crops have shriveled up and there's no water left. And so that pain of feeling terrified of what we're facing, I've been wrestling with for a number of years, and I'm excited that more people are talking about that because for a long time, no one's understood why it's hard for me to choose a future path. And I feel like that's already been my reality for a couple years, and I'm happy that other people are ready to tackle that question too.
These people you're talking about don't feel you're on your future path?
Well, yeah. Well, we can talk about that.
Sorry about that. I know what you're talking about. I was never a career oriented person myself, and I think that, we're of different generations ourselves, but certainly I remember my parents were definitely of that generation. I think that's faded to some extent, also because the economic situation has made it a different reality where people are not necessarily on that kind of classic career path. But yeah, I think people who are locked into that way of thinking, which is interesting because that is that way of thinking that is actually put into question by the things we're talking about. That's the thing that really wigs me out, this idea of stability that we've sort of built in. I mean, even though this capitalist system is dramatically unstable, there is still the sense that things are going to continue as they have continued, whatever that means, and it messes with your mind. That just think that you know, whatever your future, whatever plans you had for yourself or having kids or stuff is, you know, or the possibility that, you know, the things that many of us work for, in addition to stopping climate change, you know, the end to white supremacy, the end to patriarchy, these things that, you know, that take time to work out, that also messes with it. Anyway, lots to talk about. The number to call in to join this conversation as it develops is 503-231-8187. Yeah, well, let's get, you know, I know you've been working with Joanna Macy for a long time, who's one of the people who's really out there talking about, I think she first started talking in terms of, you know, the, you know, nuclear issue.
Right.
And of course, those are sort of the twin dilemmas, as we see, you know, with one after the other, the BP gusher and Fukushima kind of 1-2 punch there that happened the past past number of years. So talk about what Joanna Macy talks about, what working with her has been like, how that's informed your...
Great. Okay, yeah. So for those of you who don't know about Joanna, she's a deep ecologist, systems theorist, Buddhist scholar. And she did her dissertation. And she did. She started this work actually when she was in her 50s, which I take great heart in, actually, as somebody who's of the older generation. And she combines the ideas of systems theory, ecology, and Buddhism in ways that are useful to a lot of people who are working on the front lines. And part of that is really looking at the question of... who will we be under any circumstances? How do living systems work and not work? And how can we, you know, strive to predict and then things change unexpectedly? And how the experience of honoring our pain for the world, as well as honoring the beauty of the world, serves our movement and serves the world in a way, because it's in systems terms, she calls it like the blocking of feedback. When you shut down emotionally, you're blocking feedback about what needs to be released and what truth can emerge from that experience. So a lot of the work that we do is around allowing despair, anger, grief, fear emerge, not as a form of catharsis, but as a form of connection and as a form of truth-telling.
What's the difference?
Catharsis and connection. Catharsis is just like, I'm going to get rid of this. I'm going to release it and I'm done. Connection is, I'm not alone with this. I am not, I am with other people, and there's a piece of truth and there's a piece of communion that happens as a result. As much as when there's truth in community, communion around gratitude, around community, around, you know, generosity, around love. So both of those things, the gratitude, this is the process, this is the language that we use, gratitude and honoring our pain for the world, allow us to see ourselves as integrated into a larger body of earth, that we are not separate. That we are not separate in our pain, we are not separated in our gratitude and joy. And that means that's the deep ecological viewpoint, that we are the reason that we can watch coverage of Syrian refugees struggling in pain to get to safety, and we can cry at that coverage, is because we know that we're not separate from them. Our capacity for connection and our grief around what's happening to the planet means that we are a part of the planet, that we are alive, and that we are in this moment, and we're part of a larger body. Which then, ideally in this process, motivates us to be a part of whatever healing can happen. And there's many ways to do it. It's not all about activism, but that is one piece of, you know, the motivating factor, I think, is sort of waking people up and helping people offer their gifts to the world, which are not all the same. So this work, I mean, is deeply important to me because she never sugarcoated it, that this is going to, like, we're all going to get out okay. That there's a thing that she says, which is we don't know whether we are midwives to a sustainable world in the work that we do, or a living world, or a better world, or whatever, or if we're hospice workers to a dying world. But she said essentially the work is the same. The work is the same in that we are there, we are fully present, we are paying attention, and we try to mitigate pain and harm as best we're able.
One thing that, before I let Maya, and I know we have one caller waiting, that just struck me, this idea of the, you know, the connection to Earth, which, you know, being an Earth firster and being around, what were those all species, John Seed's workshops he used to do, all that kind of stuff, you know, I really absorbed that. And plus, you know, just being out in nature and having worked on a farm in Italy, it kind of integrated into the natural systems for many years, sort of, I felt that. I feel that perhaps a little less now, but the what strikes me is this, you know, if you look at the whole development of this civilizational industrial complex, that there's been, you know, this sort of, well, look even further back, there's this sort of idea that we have that, you know, primitive people were like afraid of nature, you know, and so that's why, you know, we had to develop fire to see and to eventually, you know, conquer nature, this whole mythology of the, you know, whatever, the development of the idea of progress in the sense that the West has developed it. And then, you know, we've actually been engaging in this conquering and war on nature for centuries and longer. But now, strangely, it seems like with the idea of climate change, it seems like it's coming back on us, and that there's actually this, you know, and again, there's all these strange sort of, I don't know.
Yeah, like climate chaos is the ultimate feedback loop.
Right. Exactly. And, yeah. You know, the idea of, you know, you can think of the idea of like the people anthropomorphize it and, you know, nature is having its revenge. I don't tend to like go in that route. Mm-hmm. But anyway, well, let's just go to our caller and hear what they have to say. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I was just listening to you guys, and something that you said, like, really struck with me about, like, what choices you're going to make for, like, you know, grad school and stuff like that, how it's harder to make those decisions because of the uncertainty of the future. And it reminded me of when I was in high school, and I was in high school about 20 years ago, in my physics class, my teacher brought in a guest speaker, and they had been working in Australia, and they were telling us about the hole in the ozone layer and about how people would get cancer, like, in 1 hour. People would go out in the sun and get cancer, like, in 1 hour. And it was really extreme, I remember. And I remember, like, towards the end of their talk, like, the guy was saying something about, like, you know, not knowing whether or not he wanted to have kids or anything like that, or, like, this kind of this weird, like, hopelessness, like, towards the future. And I never really hear anything about any holes in the ozone layer, like, lately. And I don't know. I just felt like calling in and saying that. It just, I don't know, like, just because I'm trying to figure out the truth, you know, myself, of, like, you know, what's really going on, where should my mental energy be put? Because some of this stuff seems so abstract with, like, the climate and so huge. And I was listening to Cable the other day, and they were talking about the climate, and whoever the guest was saying about how the effects of climate change are, like, on the fringe, like, of our society, or, like, on the fringe of our ecosystem, and that, like, in the cities, we don't really feel it and stuff like that. And I'm just, I don't know, I'm just kind of, like, still, like, up in the air on, like, I don't know, just the whole future.
Great.
It's interesting.
Yeah, what does future look like, and has it even changed, knowing that we're facing potential CC species death? Someone I was talking to who means a lot to me last night about this article said that
wait, hold on. You're both talking at once here.
Sounds like a loop.
We can't. You're really fading in and out. We thought you were done speaking, so Maya started speaking. So maybe you could try to get a better connection with your phone or something. But go ahead, Maya.
Yeah. So, and what this person told me was, you know, every person who's born into this world knows they're going to die.
Yeah.
And we still go through our whole life making art or studying things or producing food or caring for other people. And somehow that gives us meaning, and it plays into how we interact with each other. But we still do it anyways. And for me, facing the questions of what does my future look like? Where are we going with this? Looking at that question and trying to address this problem, trying to think is how can I apply myself into this terrible mess has been what I want to do with my life. And this isn't a pitch to get everyone to suddenly spend all their time working on climate change, but I think it's just one of the options for how people are spending their lives is looking right into the face of what's coming down the pipeline. And that's been important for me. The abstractness of climate change is really tough. And you mentioned that in cities, maybe people don't feel it as much as folks who are out in rural areas and see the effects on the land and see their water wells drying up and don't have alternate options for where their food is coming from necessarily. And I think that's really important. And fortunately or unfortunately, we are going to start feeling the effects of climate change in cities, in the global north, even here in Portland, very soon. And whether we feel the effects as thousands of people moving to Portland from California because the water in California is drying up, or we feel the effects from summer heat waves or something like that, I think that it will become less and less abstract. And for lots of parts of the world, climate change is not an abstract idea. And tapping into that, and you mentioned that you just want to know what the truth is and figure out what's going on, and I think we're there. we're starting to look at the truth of what's going on, even for people who feel like they're very removed from the effects of climate change.
I just want to add in that, so I was mentioned that I started a program for 350 PDX called the Climate Odyssey. And it was coming out of the place of like, this is a different story now than that we're living in, that more and more of us are living in. We're not living in a story that, you know, we're going to defeat, you know, we're right and they're wrong and we're going to fix it. It was more like, we're all on a really long journey together, trying to get home. We don't know whether we'll make it. We don't know what home will look like if we get there. But we're this hardy band of whatever, going through, you know, crossing these thresholds, coming across the sirens and the cyclops and the Koch brothers and whatever, to be on this journey together. And so it reframes for me, and I think for other people, and gives us permission to find a way to be with this kind of uncertainty. But it's also in the context of an organization that's working for climate justice locally and in other ways. So it's this interesting, sort of paradoxical, but not really in my mind.
Is the caller still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Did you have anything else to say?
So what exactly can like an individual do to like, I guess, I'm putting air quotes on this, combat climate change, or like to try and
okay, well that's enough of a question, I think. and we got a couple other callers, so thank you very much for calling in, we really appreciate it. Maya, or either of you, I could try to answer that too.
Yeah What can an individual do in the face of climate change is definitely a big question and also really exciting. There's so many ways right now to plug into the climate movement, and it sort of depends on what do you know, what are you excited about, and what would you spend hours and hours of your time doing, knowing that it might not really have that much of an impact in the long run if the climate scenarios we're looking at actually are playing out. So there's the industrial agriculture industry that you could join the fight against. There's the fossil fuel fights that you could join. Here in Portland, there's a huge group of people working to stop all new fossil fuel infrastructure and
trying to help us transition off of fossil fuel use. There's a lot of folks that are trying to defend our forests in the Pacific Northwest. These are some of the best forests in the world for capturing and storing carbon. And there's continued pressure to log those forests, and we just absolutely need them. So if you are outdoorsy and want to work on forest stuff, you can jump into that work. And there's also, I'm part of an organization called 350 PDX. PDX is for Portland. And we focus primarily on fighting the fossil fuel industry. And so you can come to public hearings with us to argue to our legislators to stop new fossil fuel infrastructure, or help out through doing data entry or doing research or writing about how this makes you feel. Really excited. You can check us out at 350pdx.org.
I'm also going to mention Kathleen, the writer Kathleen Dean Moore. She said she gets asked this question, what can one individual do? And she said, my response is, stop being an individual. Yeah. Like, think about how you can join. And it doesn't, you know, all of Maya's suggestions are great, but there's other ways of, you know, being an artist that, you know, with a consciousness. What's your intention here around even just like cooking for, you know, some event or something? There's a lot of different ways, but this idea that individually we're going to do it is not going to wash, really.
So that infrastructure ban should be talked about at some point. I know we've talked about it on KBOO and the news and other places. But let's go to, I believe, Nadine. You're on the air.
Yes, hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. This is something that really frustrates me, because people dance around the idea of a plant-based diet. That is the best thing that you can do to help prevent climate change. It is, you know, and for some reason, everyone ignores it. Factory farms. I think somebody mentioned industrial agriculture, which is one way of saying it. But, you know, people want their burgers. And, you know, as far as this station, to begin with, I love KBOO and I love your show, but nobody talks about plant-based diet. And when you consider all the land that is used and wasted, the ranches and the rainforest, and it's just ridiculous that hardly anyone ever talks about this. And I've been vegan for almost 30 years. I do not participate in any, you know, I don't have anything to do with any of this. You know, I don't contribute, let's say, to any of this, you know, factory farms or anything. And if more people would do it, it would make a huge difference. But for some reason, and the environmental groups too, they don't want to hear about plant-based diets, and I'd like to know why nobody talks about it.
Well, that's a good point. My response is I should probably talk about it more on this show. I know mm-hmm. Ralph Nader said something that really struck me. He thinks that the emphasis on going strictly vegan might not be mm-hmm. the most effective strategy on this.
And why would that be?
Well, just because if you actually get everybody to reduce dramatically their consumption, which is might be more achievable, it would actually have a huge impact. If you would get someone, for example, instead of eating meat 5 times a week, to eat meat once or twice, if you got more people to do that instead of the relatively small number of people who are likely to completely switch to veganism. And I just think it's a slight shift in emphasis, but I don't know. I always thought that was a good point to make.
Well, I understand what you're saying. There's Meatless Mondays. You probably heard about that, Meatless Mondays. And the thing is, though, is that not only would it be better for the earth, but it would be more compassionate. I mean, when you think of factory farms,
it's just
horrendous.
Nadine, I'm glad you brought this up. I definitely think I agree with you that there isn't enough sort of organizational effort to tackle the agriculture and how the United States and the dominant culture in the United States eat. One thing I want to talk to is this idea that eating a vegan diet means you don't contribute to the agriculture industry.
Right.
And I think that's false, but I think that people can work on it. So even if you're not eating, and this is not an argument not to go vegan, I think everyone who has the means and the body to go vegan, that's great. Put that effort in. But also our tax dollars go into the agriculture industry. So, you know, as Barbara said, what can we do? Don't be an individual. Be a mass. Be a mass of people. And you know, I think if the people who feel really strongly that fighting industrial agriculture and the factory farms through vegan diets, also through effort into changing the rebate and reimbursement system to factory farms and industrial agriculture, could have a really big impact.
We're fighting corporations. We're fighting these huge corporations that go to South America and kill people because they want to protect their land from ranching and, well, other things too. But they kill people to do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, people, it's not really discussed. It's also a social justice issue. But the thing is, if you're an environmentalist, you can't be a true environmentalist and not be on a plant-based diet.
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling, Nadine. We got a couple other callers, and you've introduced a very important subject. I actually personally disagree, because I think there are some places on the planet where you can actually have animals and eat them in a way that is sustainable, as they say.
Definitely not through the U.S. supermarkets. So.
Definitely not true in the U.S. supermarkets. I wish that, you know, I wish that more people would be focusing on those huge feedlots in Southern California, especially during the drought. That would have been a really great, you know, if we could do more of these intersectional campaigns where people come together on key strategic places like they did on the Dakota Access Pipeline. But more of them, I think it would have a resonant impact. I think those Southern California feedlots should be a major source of struggle. But that's a big subject, and we could go around and around on that. Let's just go to our next caller, Sean.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to thank one of your guests for that beautiful quote about being a hospice worker. I think it's worth repeating later on in the show at some point. I just really thought that was very beautiful. That takes a lot of strength, and some of us, unfortunately, can't muster that strength, but I think it's a beautiful quote, and I hope it can be repeated later on in the show. Maybe kind of piggybacking on the last caller, I think I'd change what she said a little bit. I would say you can't really be an environmentalist and also defend free markets and private enterprise and the capitalist system. One of the reasons I listen to your show, Paul, is you do a wonderful job of incorporating class-based politics, anti-capitalist politics, into environmentalism. And along those lines, you know, sometimes if I'm feeling really isolated and I want to have my despair validated, I'll go and I'll read Derek Jensen, or I'll read John Zerzan, or one of the anarcho-primitivists, or something like that. But if I'm wanting to feel, you know, combative, and I want to renew my fighting spirit, the first person I turn to is a guy named Joel Cavell, something like that. He founded something called eco-socialism, and I guess, Paul, I don't understand why we don't hear more about him, because I can't find a more articulate person who both combines, you know, radical environmentalism with also, you know, a staunchly anti-capitalist, you know, Marxist analysis of the problem.
Is that K-O-V-E-L?
Joel, J-O-E-L, K-O-V-E-L.
I'll look him up. I'm familiar with eco-socialism, and
he has a great book out called Enemy of Nature, but you know, just listening to you, Paul, I mean, it's half the time it sounds like you're reading him, because, I mean, he's stridently anti-capitalist. I mean, he wants to see a socialist future, and he also emphasizes that, you know, if you're going to have a system that promotes consumerism, you're just clueless if you think you're going to have true environmentalism so long as our entire economic system is promoting consumerism. And I heard Derek Jensen the other day talking about something called Javan's Law. This is like a theory in economics from the 19th century in England. But this whole idea of the techno fix that, you know, we have new technologies and we think that's going to lead to an environmental future. But, oh, oops, by the way, that's just going to increase more consumption, you know. So it's
the law of unintended consequences, yeah.
Anyway, I'll let you go with that. And I really appreciate the show. And thank you for your guests. Bye-bye. All right.
Thanks, Sean.
So I want to address, as I was preparing for this morning, I was reading a lot of sort of responses to the original article. And I found one by Susan Matthews in Slate Magazine. And essentially, one of the things that she talked about was one of the things we're looking at, and this goes straight to what you were saying, Sean, is that the people, the powers that be, in this culture and in this country, it's not that they don't believe in climate change. They just don't care. It doesn't fit their model of profit and us and them and hierarchy and authoritarianism and all that other stuff. So yes, you are right in that piece that really people who say they're denying climate change is just a line. They're, you know, anybody who has any intelligence knows that that's not true. And, you know, all of the things where, you know, I'm not even going to bring our president into the conversation, but anybody else who's talking about this, they are not really denialists. They are there to protect the status quo for as long as they're able in terms of the capitalist system. So that's one piece. And one other thing that I want to say about Joanna's work related to what you said about consumerism is that it's interesting. It sounds a little woo-woo to have like gratitude be a part of the work that we're doing in terms of changing the world, but gratitude is the resistance to the consumerist culture, you know, because essentially the culture is telling us we don't have enough, we aren't good enough, we aren't pretty enough, whatever it is. And to be able to nurture and ground in something that gives you a sense of sufficiency and gives you a sense of connectivity and gives you a sense of power is what fuels those of us who are working for whatever healing we can.
So this is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. My name's Paul Rowland. I'm speaking with Barbara Ford and Maya Jared, both with 350 PDX. And we're talking, this is I think the third straight week. I've talked last week, I focused exclusively on this article, The Uninhabitable Earth, Famine, Economic Collapse, A Sun That Cooks Us, What Climate Change Could Wreak Sooner Than You Think, by David Wallace Wells, July 9th in New York Magazine, which is, as I said last week, I think this has stirred up probably more attention, certainly more reaction from scientists, activists, other journalists, across the board than any other article that I know of. So it's, you know, it served a purpose just in that alone. And the whole issue of, you know, apocalypticism, catastrophism, or is that helpful? Is it alarmist? Is it completely accurate? He has since released a extremely lengthy, The Uninhabitable Earth and Uninhabitable Earth annotated edition, which with exhaustive footnotes and further quotes from scientists. He's also released a series of follow-up articles with more extensive. He is based on many interviews with, I think, 25 climate scientists, he said. I can't remember exactly. And some of these follow-up articles are more extensive interviews, sections of the interviews with those scientists themselves, including with Michael Mann, who's been one of his main critics in the scientific community, among others. And if you really want to get into this, if you really want to get into this subject, this would be a good place to do it. If you got time, if you got any time on your hands, and I know that's also a big if for a lot of us. I happen to have, just because of my circumstances, which I don't need to go into, but so I'm more than willing to do some of that and help to bring it to you, and I hope that it serves some purpose. So anyway, we've got 15 minutes left. I've been talking a lot. I know we wanted to talk a little bit about this infrastructure ban, because a lot of the focus of the climate activists in Portland has been on that, and it recently got overturned in the courts, at least partially based upon these doctrines of law, which favor basically federal and state law trumps local laws, which has overturned quite a few initiatives around the country to combating various things, toxic and harmful things, and based partially upon the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which is a big subject. Mayo, would you like to just briefly talk about it? Because I know that's something that people put a lot of effort into, and so it's something that's still going on. Where is that at right now?
Yeah, so the policy that you're talking about that's been overturned is the City of Portland's fossil fuel terminal zoning code change that was passed in 2016. And this policy was one of the most aggressive policies in the nation at the time, that banned all new construction of what's called transloading facilities for fossil fuels. That's coal, oil, and natural gas. And that's one of the things that made it very strong. And also massive storage of these fuels. And the policy was appealed to the Oregon State Land Use Board of Appeals.
And who appealed it?
I believe it was the Columbia Pacific Building Trades.
And the Portland Business.
Definitely. PBA, Portland Business Association, was a big part of that as well. And part of the appeal was sustained, and part of the appeal was denied. And so what does that mean? What are we looking at now that policy has been appealed? Well, there is a chance that lawyers are going to appeal the appeal, and so there's an option for that to happen. And since the policy is appealed, we're now looking at, well, how do we basically, as the community of Portland, decide we are going to uphold the values of that policy regardless of what the law has overturned? And what the values of the policy say are, it's hazardous to have fossil fuels on liquefaction zones in Portland, so we aren't going to allow any more to be built. We want them to be moved, and we don't want any transloading facilities of fossil fuels built in Portland. There's possibility of trying a couple other different measures locally to have a similar impact. So we could try passing a moratorium like some other places in the country. It's a huge bummer that the Land Use Board of Appeals basically allowed for the appeal of this policy to happen, but it doesn't mean that the facilities necessarily are gonna be built anyways.
And of course, there's the community rights people would say that was almost a foregone conclusion because of these doctrines of law, which make it really difficult for local, for municipalities and local governments to actually govern themselves and to go against these things that are harmful to their own citizens, again, because of the power of the Commerce Clause, the built into the U.S. Constitution itself, which is a subject that I've gotten into some, and for probably another time, because we're running out of time today. Let's just go to our next caller. David, you're on the air. Whoops, I guess, David, you're not on the air. So, yeah, this is a big thing, this infrastructure ban. I know not only have people put a lot of effort into it and seen it as important and good thing for our local area, but it was an important precedent. A number of, I know Richmond, California has been strong in standing up against fossil fuel infrastructure and others. And that's one area where people feel that they can actually have some serious influence. Another thing we want to talk about, there's so many issues we're talking about, you know, how personally and collectively we deal with these huge, overwhelming things. How do we feel a continued sense of meaning in the sense of an uncertain future? We're talking about local activism. Another thing we were talking about in advance of the show, and that I actually noted in my introduction, what actually has a chance of stopping climate change is something that always kind of gets talked about at the very end of these programs. And it's a big subject, so it deserves a program all its own, which I promise to do, people hear about these things like sort of science fiction solutions, big technological solutions, which I have always found anathema, which is one approach. Another approach is the mass struggle approach, which rose up with the DAPL pipeline. Another approach is the individual or small group direct action approach, which these courageous women, Catholic worker, two women from Iowa did, which I encourage people to read about. They did a series of just mind-bogglingly well-planned and executed sabotages, which I, of course, can make no position publicly on the air about, but were certainly dramatic. And if you read their statement, which I'll link to on the program page, it's they're very persuasive in what they say. So there's various approaches, a various range of approaches from policy, direct action, large scale mass struggle, legal approaches. Then there's also the issue of large-scale technological solutions, which I think people have really been shying away from. I don't know that, Maya, that's what you specifically wanted to talk about. But there's a feeling from some of the climate scientists that I've talked to that the only way to actually have a chance of protecting some form of climate stability into the distant future are actually ways of removing carbon from the atmosphere and actually masking the heating effects of the sun on a temporary basis to buy us some time while we can possibly work some of these things out. So I don't know, I threw a lot on the table for the next 7 or 8 minutes.
Great. Okay, so now that we have these worst case scenarios on the table and everyone's like suddenly really freaking out and we're desperate for averting those worst case scenarios, let's throw all of the possibilities of fighting climate change on the table. And there are a number of possible ways to address climate change that you mentioned, one of which being sort of geoengineering, or, you know, we could lump in nuclear energy or a whole bunch of others that large organizations, small and large organizations and people, communities of people around the world are calling false solutions to climate change. And the reason they're called false solutions is because they may take certain actions against carbon, or they may be carbon reduction, but they aren't a solution for everyone at the table, meaning they harm some people while some people are going to be around to feel the benefits of the carbon reduction. So basically, they throw some people under the bus, or they throw some ecosystems under the bus, or they throw some waterways under the bus in exchange for the potential for carbon reduction
specifically
down the line. So specifically, we could look at nuclear. That's sort of one of the false solutions that's been named, where you have to go mine your material. And so the communities where the uranium is mined, they can't use their water anymore. And so for them, there may be global carbon reductions if nuclear is reducing the fossil fuels energy that's used, but they may not be around because of cancers that their community has experienced from the uranium mining and their water systems.
Well, here, let me just a little pushback, and I know we have very little time, but there's apparently a thing called a molten salt reactor, which is an old technology that was conceived during the Cold War and foregoes solid nuclear fuel for a liquid one, which it can burn with far greater efficiency than any power technology in existence. It also generates a small fraction of the radioactive waste compared to today's commercial reactors, which all rely on solid fuel. And in theory, molten salt reactors can never melt down. This is a very recent article which I came across. And again,
what's that? I said that sounds.
It's interesting. Cool, it's the kind of thing that I think we don't. A lot of us are averse to these kind of things. You know, I know that. The Gaia hypothesis what's his name?
Lovelock.
Lovelock. He was a major proponent of nuclear power, but I was certainly against that. But again, these conversations, again, we need a full hour to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So let me let you continue.
Yeah, the other thing I wanted to say is when these really aggressive, you know, so I don't believe we can win against climate change in that I don't think at this point we can avoid all impacts of climate change. We are already seeing impacts of climate change. We've already changed the climate. We are trying to avoid worst case scenarios. We're trying to get the best we can, have the most habitable planet we can, have the most habitable areas of the planet we can. And we know that there are some peoples around the world that are already experienced collapse of their way of living, of their land is literally disappearing into the ocean, or the salt water is coming up through their water table. I want the people who have already experienced a few decades of what it's like to have climate change completely transform their way of life, I want those people to still be around to teach me how to deal emotionally and politically with when that happens here. So, and I think that we can really turn right now to people who've survived hundreds of years of colonial oppression, and how do you deal with that grief, and how do you deal with the constant knowing that your children are growing up in a place where their traditions are sort of like lopped off, you know, the limbs of their traditions are lopped off, and how hard that is. But those people have really, really good systems of resilience, and they've practiced how to deal with the emotional impact of oppression and massive and incomprehensible terrors and horrors that their other humans have inflicted on them, or in the case of folks in island nations and also, you know, Bangladesh right now, their water's already salinated in Bangladesh. And so those are the people that I want around, you know, now and in 5 years and in 10 years, and I want them to be, you know, redistributing our resources and our wealth and writing our policies and telling us, coming into our communities and telling us how do we deal with the situation. And I hope that, you know, we're taking actions, these solutions we choose, make it so that these people actually want to work with us, because it's a huge ask and there's no guarantee that any of them will be interested in helping the United States or the folks in the United States if we, you know, engage in solutions to climate change that actually throw them under the bus or throw their cultures under the bus. And Barbara, I really want you to read this quote you have about hope, since we have two more minutes.
Okay. So one of the things when we're talking about despair is like, we're sort of looking at what is the despair, how does it affect us? And what a lot of our work is, my work and Joanna's work, is like reframing the entire meaning of hope and divorcing it completely from optimism, honestly. And so here's a great quote from Rebecca Solnit, who's one of my favorite writers and thinkers on this area. And this quote is, "Hope is not a lottery ticket that you can sit on the sofa and clutch feeling lucky. It is an axe you break down doors with in an emergency. Hope should shove you out the door because it will take everything you have to steer the future away from endless war, from the annihilation of the earth's treasures, and the grinding down of the poor and marginal. To hope is to give yourself to the future, and that commitment to the future is what makes the present inhabitable."
Well, that's going to have to end it on that note. Thank you so much, Barbara Ford, Maya Jarrad. Appreciate your being here. And this this conversation will continue. I see whole new other directions opening up. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Paul.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Don't say what you mean. That's Drinking from Puddles, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yeah, good morning. It's 9 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, it's On the Ground Radio. Today confronts attacks on health care, free speech, voting, and Second Amendment rights for people of color. At 10 o'clock, it's Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, Flashpoints.